So before beginning the talk, I'd like to really just express my appreciation for each of you being here. I permitted myself something, and, you know, don't worry, I don't do this a lot, just looking around while we were meditating together, and you all looked so peaceful, and I know that that's a complete illusion that inside, you know, there's a lot more going on, but it was just very touching, you know. It's like, oh, and it was so quiet, so still. And if you listen, it sounds to me like it's so quiet we can kind of hear birds really high up above, maybe migrating birds or something. It's like, so precious, this quality. And now I'm kind of hissing and bubbling into the room, so you have to live with that. But yeah, I just wanted to say my appreciation for you still being here. It's not taken for granted. Yeah, it's not easy what you're doing and what you're meeting, and the skill building involves challenge at times, you know, learning how to meet our experience in what's the best possible way. Right, yeah, the second thing to say is there's a translation. I think Asaf is in the back corner. Yes, there. So if at any time, including now, you feel like it probably could be helpful to have a translation, really thank you to Asaf for offering this. Yeah, thanks, Danny. In that corner over there. Getting some stage advice here, which I will follow. You don't need to worry about it. I'll probably forget. The other thing I wanted to mention, actually, before we jump into the talk, maybe it's related. I don't think it is. I'm not going to try and weave it in some clever way. Like legacy thing, like from the past, has impacted something that we said, expressed. There can be a suggestion at times on retreats. Some people like to suggest, like, not to make eye contact so much, or to experiment with eye contact. And I just want to kind of make it clear that from my side, our side, we're really fine with you making eye contact with each other. You know, and if that helps in that sense of feeling more supported, we are here together, right? And I don't think it's going to break out into some, you know, eye contact moments, and <it's> like, oh, I forgot to come into the hall. I was having such a good eye contact. I think it's just something in passing, like holding a door for each other, like being kind to each other. You know, it's really healthy and helpful, and all of this kind of thing. And by eye contact, I mean eyes. These eyes, not the eye, my eye meeting your eye. You know, it's like the visual sense of a pair of eyes meeting, and a smile and appreciation and recognition of each other here is there. How much of your eye also comes up behind your eyes? We don't need to worry about that too much. Not for today, anyway. Maybe later. So, I want to say a little bit about the ways that we're practicing. And also, inevitably, perhaps, bring in another way of practicing. And so generally, just to kind of respond to, you know, what could be or maybe should be a frequently asked question, why are you giving us another practice? Like, we've already got, you know, breath and sounds and Vedana, and now Anicca, and we've got Metta. It's like, really? Like, isn't that enough? And yeah, it's enough. And it's very possibly enough for many of us. But all of these practices are actually opening out a really fundamental insight, yeah, that our experience is conditioned. And understanding in what way it is conditioned is really, really helpful. And the more, what we say, like, the more deep, the more wide, the more thorough that understanding is, the more deep, the more wide, the more thorough our sense of freedom is, in understanding this experience is conditioned by this. Yeah. And I really know when a Vedana turns up, it's a niceness opinion and I don't have to follow it. It's not even true. Yeah. When an experience comes up and it feels like this is going to last forever, I really know this is not true. Yeah. I can see it in a different way, hold it in a different way. All of the ways that we're practicing, though, are doing the same thing, right? What they're doing is actually adjusting the dukkha quotient, you know, the amount of dukkha in life, you know. Like, and you can get it really, really small. There can still be lots of life and lots less dukkha. Yeah. So how much dukkha there is in this life is adjustable. We can change the way that dukkha expresses, and we can change the way it is conditioned. Yeah, and that's what we're exploring here. So we want to give you enough tools so that you can pick and choose, support yourself in different ways. But I would say, and we've said it before, and just really, really emphasize it out there, really make supporting yourself in ways which feel more spacious and you're capable of being more intimate, be guided by that. Be guided by that felt sense of well-being, that gatheredness in ourselves. Yeah. And also one of the reasons why we're offering maybe more practices than feel appropriate for you is that there might be some people here who are actually kind of practicing some things that maybe would be helpful to actually introduce other practices. Like, we didn't make any high or low bar of entry here. You know, this is open to everyone, and so there are some people maybe getting something that sounds a little bit more advanced might satisfy them and their ego-driven practice situation that they're entangled in. So, you know, but the nature of meditation is to cultivate freedom. From mindfulness to metta, you know, it's these ways of meeting our experience, and what we can notice, what we can be with, what we can open out into, you know, really rich, finding our capacity to ease contraction, yeah, through whatever means, the bodily fabrication, seeing deeper into experience, even like the things that just kind of come along with the practice. Actually, you notice how we're also playing with our sense of time quite a lot in practice. Yeah, that just kind of comes along with the practice. It's like, oh, I'm getting really impatient waiting for a bell to ring, and then I kind of suddenly think, wow, I give up. And then all of a sudden the bell rings. You think, how weird. You know, it's like time depends on how I relate to it. So I see all those kind of elements. Is there a possibility for me to slow down my activity and slow down time? Amazing. Yeah. Really quite remarkable what we're able to do. And as we know, you know, noticing the Vedana both to give us a deeper sense into experience and also to open out really different ways of relating to things, and actually change how those Vedanas appear. Again, kind of magic that we're learning to do, you know, how we actually shape the world that appears in our hearts, minds. Yeah. So I'm not just running through these things, I'm also adding maybe elements, ingredients, you can kind of see how these things come together. But don't worry if you're not getting everything. Yeah, just like, you know, treat it like a piece of music, if you like. Have to listen to every note, do you? So hold it in that way. And of course, this Anicca way that we've been introducing, that some of you may have picked up and really enjoyed, and we've dropped it into the metta meditation, which maybe, you know, helped there, or it didn't, it was just confusing, all of those kind of possibilities. But like, when it's opening for us, what's really interesting there is it changes how appearances appear to us. When I look this way and I start looking and I see, ah, this is inconstant. Like, I was playing it around with these sweet pea flowers. Oh, they're inconstant. And something for me, it's like, oh, it really starts to come alive in a way that, you know, they're not just a thing. They're really a blossoming thing, a emerging thing. It's more dynamic. There can also be this sense of when we pay attention to something like a sensation, that, oh, I have this pain in my knee, and then it's actually a nicha, it's actually alive, it's actually dynamic, it's actually moving. It's actually never one way. And in fact, for it to be any one way, is actually just a series of ways, and it's barely there in any definable way. That really changes how I relate to it, how I hold it, how I act towards it, how I react, how I maybe don't react, how we don't fire more arrows. I heard that teaching, you know, it's like a painful sensation arises, and then we have that. It's like being hit by one arrow, and then we fire another arrow, which is my reactivity. So I'm not having that. You know, I don't want that. Why that shouldn't happen to me, or poor me having this experience. And we see we build up the dukkha experience. A lot of these ways, Vedana and Nietzsche, are actually inviting us to different ways of relating. But I've been thinking recently that the Nietzsche way of looking is actually carries with it another really profound insight. That's building it up quite a lot, isn't it? But, it can seem to us that we hear this teaching, and I actually think it's presented this way quite a lot, is, you know, get with the truth of Nietzsche. Nothing lasts. You've got to accept that. Get with the program or you're just deluded. Yeah, and you kind of, it sometimes sounds that way. You just got to notice nothing lasts. And if you can't accept it, you just got to toughen up, because it ain't going to change. Except it is going to change. Right. But that's the, and that's the kind of the movement of that teaching. Yeah. But what it actually says, both in the teachings itself, it says, maintain the perception of change. Recommended, like top tip, maintain the perception of change. Doesn't it say anywhere, the truth of the matter is, it's all changing. Yeah. Or in other places it might say, all appearances, all conditioned things that arise also pass. See them that way. See it this way. All conditioned things that arise pass. And if you unpack that, then you can actually see that's also what happens in our experience. When you look at things through a lens of, see, this is inconstant, what happens? They become inconstant. They become transitional. They become dynamic. Why? Because we're looking at them that way. Right? That's the significant insight. When you look this way, things appear this way. That's all we can say. Is that how things really are? Well, I don't know, because if I look at them this way, they become this way. Just before, I was looking at them this way, and they became that way. Yeah? Does that make sense? Does that not make sense to anyone? I always ask that question the wrong way around. Yeah? Does that feel okay? That we can say that? So we're not talking about a truth. We don't need to talk about truth here. We just talk about what's useful. What's useful is looking at it this way, I see it this way, and it's useful. Why? Because it changes how I relate to it. And the ways that I was relating to it, like the hindrances, like Zaha spoke about, the greed, the aversion, implicit in that is that it's going to last. Do you want to go through all the effort of greeding and the contraction and the thirsting, the chasing and everything for something that's actually not even here in any particular way from its own side? Yeah. Because it's really dependent on how you look at it. That's something kind of weirder, and also quite more freeing if we can hold it that way. I know for myself that there's part of me that feels a little disappointed, maybe, at that kind of information. You know, I came here for truth, and now you're telling me, telling me even that truth that I thought you'd just given me, you're taking that back and declaring it not a truth. And yeah, we're doing that. But in exchange, more freedom. Okay? In exchange, more creativity, more possibilities. So what this opens out is the possibility of seeing that all there are perceptions. Perceptions of reality. And what we're getting to understand is how a perception of reality comes about. Yeah, depending on all of those practices that we just talked about. Yeah. Start changing the condition of the body. Even the condition of the breath, yeah, a deeper breath, starts to change how perceptions appear, how the world appears to us. Okay, it's time for me to check if anybody would like a translation. If you do at any point wish to have a translation, the nearest translator may be behind you. And just feel free to wander across to Asaf, and he'll save you. So our way of looking at our experience is a really significant part of how our experience appears. Yeah? And that goes for everything that happens, you know, kind of like in here, and everything that happens out there. You know, you might say the so-called out there, because there's actually not so much difference, really. There's a really funny thing I like to mention in this hall quite a lot, especially when it's this crowded. Maybe it's more fun for me to think about. But we're all sitting in your consciousness, you know, and it's kind of crowded in here. So if you could expand your consciousness, because we're kind of running out of room, and it's really, I mean, it's cozy in your consciousness, I must admit. It's a pleasure to be here giving a talk in your, each of your consciousnesses. But it's getting tight. That's the only thing. So all of that is perceptions in consciousness, right? Everything that occurs to us. And the insight is that everything that appears in consciousness is a conditioned perception. So, with that understanding, there's an invitation. Like, what's the most supportive, beautiful, liberating way of perceiving this perception? Right? And really allowing for the fact that it might seem weird, it might seem unreasonable, it might seem rude even at times, to find the most supportive, creative way of relating to our experience. And so the way that I'm going to encourage us to regard all of our experience is to say, absolutely everything is dukkha. Did I open the wrong notes? So, hold fire. Close the door. Don't let anyone out. You'll know that from the teachings, the Buddha was really clear about this from the beginning. You know that. Okay. And the Buddha said, life is suffering, right? That's what he said. Life with no disappointment in their lovely voice, just said, the first noble truth is life is suffering. Probably not. Probably didn't say that. The first statement is there is suffering. There is dukkha. Yeah. And I know that Zohar really enjoyed growing up watching The Prince's Bride. Is that right? You used to quote to me this line from it. My name is... What was his name? Yeah. Oh, you didn't enjoy it? Okay. I didn't know. I didn't see it, so... Is it not good? Okay. Sorry. Oh, you did enjoy it? Okay. We don't know. It's unknown. So, yeah. Inigo Montoya, is it? Inigo? Okay. Okay. But there's this particular line from it that's enjoyable where he says to the person, it's the person saying, it's inconceivable. And he says, you keep using this word, but I do not think it means what you think it means. Yeah, something like this. So, dukkha. You keep using this word, but I do not think it means what you think it means. Yeah. What does it mean? And it's such an important word for us. If we're going to start calling things dukkha, I really think we have to be clear about what we mean here. Yeah. And so let's just kind of take a few steps through. So if we see it in terms of the Four Noble Truths, this dukkha is a conditioned experience. What is it conditioned by? Is the question in the second Noble Truth, right? So in life there is dukkha, so we could say sometimes. And that dukkha is conditioned by, and normally the thing is something like craving or thirsting, demanding, however you kind of translate this word. But we can actually open out that question and say, what that question literally is when there's dukkha, what else is there? When there's dukkha, what else is there? And we talked about a few of these things. There's an intense sense of time pressure. Yeah, there's quite an urgency to the dukkha experience. There's a strong sense of self there, because there's dukkha's happening to somebody and it ain't happening to me. Kind of that kind of experience there. There's that kind of pushing and pulling on experience that we talk about. There's a contraction in the energetics, in the awareness that's unfolding there. So it's very clear that dukkha in the Four Noble Truths is a conditioned experience. Yeah. And it's conditioned by the reactivity that comes along with any moment of the dukkha experience. And when those conditions disappear, now we find ourselves in the territory of the third noble truth, which is there is a release, a relief, an ending of dukkha. And there is a path that gets you there, the path of understanding conditions and reconditioning or decommissioning the conditions that give rise to dukkha. Yeah. And so we might say, so the Buddha's saying that there's only dukkha when we cling to it, when we push to it, when we hold to it, when we engage with it in those ways. And then just as we're kind of thinking, okay, yeah, I can get with that. It's my reactivity, I need to watch out for that. It's my building up my sense of self, it's all this kind of thing, and I can work with that. But then the Buddha goes and says, sabbe sankhara dukkha. Well, first he says, apparently says, you know, sabbe sankhara anicca, all the conditioned experiences are anicca. Yeah, see it this way. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, see it this way. All appearances are dukkha. All appearances are dukkha. And so that's the invitation as a practice. Anything that appears, it's dukkha. So a phrase like suffering or stress or distress, which are pretty good translations for the word dukkha, might not quite feel like what we want to be saying or implying or meaning. Yeah, anything that appears, the smell of the earth after rain, yeah, it's dukkha. It's stressful. It's a bummer. It's suffering. But it's an appearance. And it's a conditioned experience. It's a conditioned appearance. Yeah. So wondering which way to go. So maybe I'll give you what I feel is actually a really helpful phrase. And that is unsatisfactory. Unsatisfactory. And actually there's a fun little joke. Many of you will have heard of Tanisiro Bhikkhu. He's quite well known as a translator of Pali text. I think he's really quite good at it. And as a translator, this being needs to find a translation for the word dukkha sometimes. Yeah, we're kind of at the front of this moment of our talk is actually getting a good translation of dukkha. As soon as you think you found the single best translation for the word, think again. For no matter how you describe dukkha, it's always deeper, subtler, and more unsatisfactory than that. And so I think he's made an inside joke, but nicely done. So anything that appears is dukkha, according to this teaching. And we've got to have a sense the Buddha's trying to free us in some way. He's trying to offer us some invitation here. And again, trying to invite us to perceive a certain way to maximize freedom. Yeah, just as we did with the Anicca way. Not because it's true, but because it's useful. Yeah, and because the invitation is to perceive in ways that maximize freedom. Yeah, that's our invitation. So, yeah, I think unsatisfactoriness is actually a really nice translation for this experience. But maybe first of all we can just give a little thought about where happiness comes from. And I really almost began to struggle to find a better example, and I know some of you will know this example. But in the end, I just thought, well, this really is just a very, very good example. And it invites just a fun little game that we can play. And I honestly do not mind if you already think you remember the answer. You can still give what you think is the correct answer. But some time ago, an experimenter wanted to find out at what point people who go shopping experience happiness. And they didn't invite me to come because I think never. It would be kind of a common answer for many of us. Actually, suffering is shopping. Shopping is suffering. There's no difference. But some people who they found who actually enjoy the activity of shopping, and I hope there's probably some of you in here because we're going to need some empathy otherwise to be able to guess where in the shopping experience between being given a credit card with about $100 or worth of credit on it and going into a shop with whatever, clothes, finding something that they would like to own or buy for someone else, whatever it is. I think it was to own for themselves, to wear for themselves, and then check it out and go out of the shop, take off the electrodes, anodes, whatever it is. So it's measuring not happiness, but excitation, actually, literally. Yeah, like, oh, there's, you know, whatever stuff coming up on the skin because I'm feeling excited. So it's not really happiness, it's excitement. But aside from that, so a person goes into the shop, experiences maximum happiness when, let's say, they go into the shop, they see something they like, they take it off, they see it's going to fit, they try it on, they put it back on the hanger and go to the checkout person, give them the credit card and get it in a bag, and they go out and go home. Now, where do you think maximum happiness is? Anyone want to make a guess? Just before paying? Lovely. Yes? Just after paying? Okay. Yeah? Yeah? Lovely. Yes? Yes. When in the looking, when the, and see something they like, or just looking, just the looking. Nice. Yeah, Danny. Nice. And yes, please. No, same. Okay. Yeah. Any other? Yes. Like before you go in the shop, when you like, ooh. Yeah. Nice. Really good. Yes. Anyone else want to add anything? Getting home? Yeah. Nice. Yes. Okay. And then it's mine. Yeah. Nice. Oh, yes. One more. When they lose it. Yeah. So that, yeah. And they're out of the experiment. But yeah, it's also a really nice guess. So, you know, it's a study, it's a game, it's something that we can kind of play around with. And it's helpful for us to kind of imagine where we actually imagine the happiness peaks for us, right? According to the study, I think that they discovered, it was, I think, our first guess, which was in that moment just before paying. Isn't it? Something like that? Yeah, so. Okay, I better say it through here, so thanks. Yeah, so when you're handing over the card and you're just about to get the thing back to yourself, there's that sense of happiness is kind of released. And that's more the point I want to get to, but like it does tie in with the Buddha's teaching, which is that the suffering is in the grasping, the craving, the thing like that, and that's actually what goes down there. Yeah, so it's really kind of helpful to kind of see that in our lived experience. But all those other moments that people mentioned are also really delightful little moments. And there's definitely peaks there, and it might be the peak for us and actually where we get the maximum enjoyment. And also to remember they're measuring excitement, not happiness, something that can be measured. And maybe happiness can't be fully measured. But the more important question in that experiment is, like, where did the happiness come from? Who brought it into the shop? Was it made in the factory? You know, is it, like, put on the clothes and kind of washes off, like, pixie dust, angel dust? Is that... You get enough of it, and then somehow in that kind of transaction, it's there. Okay, right. Obviously, we brought it into the shop with us, and we allowed it to come out in that funny little movement with credit card and bag exchange. It's like, now I'm going to release it. Whoa! So the question would be, could we have released it earlier without all that kind of dancing around and fast fashion impact on the environment and us having to wear those funny little... anodes and, you know, debt mentality stuff going on with, like, I never have enough money and now they've given it to me. And yeah. So there's something really interesting coming up in terms of, like, where does happiness come from? And if happiness is released in releasing the push, the pull, the desire, the aversion, the agitation, the contraction, and all of that, then isn't that the skill that we need to learn how to do? And so, unsatisfactory. That dress was unsatisfactory. It did not contain satisfaction. Satisfaction is the factory. Satisfactory is a factory where you make stuff. Yeah, so you would need a big old vat of satis, and satis means enoughness. Yeah, and then you have this factory where they make enoughnesses. Nothing can make you enough. You get enough, you want another enough. Yeah, you say it's enough after enough after enough, but there's none of them contain enough, because there's no factory of enoughness in a thing. And there's no enoughness in any factory. Right? They're not putting it into stuff. You bring that sense of enoughness. Oh, now I'm enough because of some exchange. I allow myself to feel enough, right? So interestingly, no thing contains enoughness, okay? Sabbe sankhara dukkha. No thing contains enoughness from its own side. Just depends how you relate to it. Some things you allow yourself to feel enough in their company. Yeah. And this might sound really kind of self-centered or something like that. It's like you just need to be happy in yourself. That's not what it's saying exactly. It's actually saying don't deny yourself of the happiness of enoughness by chasing out here in places where it does not exist. Yeah. Do you know there's a story from the Sufi tradition, I think it is, where there's a famous idiot plays the fool, yeah, Nasruddin, and one day he's outside under a streetlight crawling around looking for his car keys. And eventually a policeman comes and he's helping him. He's like, are you sure you lost them here? He's like, no, I lost them over there in the dark, but the light is so much better here. And we're just looking for those things in the wrong places. Yeah. But unsatisfactory also means undissatisfactory. Right? It's not to say everything is dissatisfactory. Yeah, which is actually dis is to pull away from. Yeah, to pull us away from the factory of satis. Yeah. The enoughness. To pull us away from enoughness. Ah, I got, you know, the burnt rice, the dissatisfaction, you know, of that experience, you know. No, didn't do anything, actually. I decided not to release woe is me, you know, unhappiness. It was like, no, it was perfectly fine, perfectly good. Yeah. Oh, I got rained on. You know, so dissatisfactory. So, yeah, it's fine. Turns out I'm waterproof. Is there dissatisfaction in things? A really important question for us to explore, yeah? Because we often live that way, projecting that into it. The last thing I want to say about this is we can feel that if we say something like that about life, it's going to become kind of flat, meaningless, empty in kind of a really negative way. Yeah. And so if that's your feeling, then it might take some daring, yeah, to say that to an experience. Even a very beautiful experience. Even a very pleasant feeling. It's unsatisfactory. But if it encourages us not to grab on, not to grip, not to push, not to pull in the normal ways, not to increase agitation, we might actually find, actually open something really joyful for us. And many people who practice this way actually discover that saying this is unsatisfactory suddenly get hit by quite a wave of happiness. And sometimes it can be this way that we can also look at life and we could say, you know, this isn't peaceful. And then suddenly, peace comes into the being. The power of perception, the creativity of our attention and our intentions, should not be underestimated. So tomorrow, for those who wish to, we can explore what it's like to hear, sense, taste, and whatever it is. So unsatisfactory. And it's not a rejection. It's not putting anything down. It's not saying that life is not enough. But it's saying, what happens when I really don't demand for things to satisfy me? So I hope this talk has been thoroughly unsatisfactory. And let's just have an unsatisfactory moment together to close. Whatever you've got in your mind right now does not contain satisfaction or dissatisfaction from its own side. Thank you for your presence, your participation. No phenomena were hurt in the making of this talk. And we'll enjoy some walking meditation now and come back for the last practice together at 9 o'clock.